my great pleasure to welcome Tim and Chris Hallbaum.
Thank you.
Well, Sylvia, you're going to be a tough act to follow.
I know. So it's great to see you all here this morning on this third day of our conference. And what we wanted to do at this time would be to share with you an experience we had last year, but also in the service of having you think through creating some kind of template for your own healing should you approach an issue or have a health challenge or something comes up in your life. I know when Robert and Susie and I first wrote our book, Beliefs Pathway to Health and Well-Being, we started getting a lot of calls from people saying, oh, my mom's got cancer, would you work with her? And of course, we could only stretch so far, so we'd say, well, where do you live? And they'd say something like, Chicago. So we'd look through who we knew in Chicago and often make a referral. And then we get a call back from the NLP practitioner saying, why'd you refer that person to me? They have a physical issue. And we kept saying, well, you deal with it, you know, the same kind of way. And so often we've seen people who have some kind of health challenge come up in their life, and they come become like deer in the headlights, and they don't use their NLP skills. Remember, Susie and I were on some tour training together, and we talked to three or four people in a row, and somebody would say, I've got this really bad cold. And Susie would go, well, did you go and drop inside and ask what that's about and communicate with it? And they go, oh, I didn't think of that. And that just that kind of thing happened repeatedly. So if you, our goal today is to help you think through what you might do should something arise in your life so that you kind of have a mental template so that it's not just suddenly not being certain what to do. And I think often when you're suddenly in a position where you're dealing with a health crisis, a lot of times you lose all your programs for what to do. And so by the end of today, we're hoping that you've had a chance to really think through what you might do should you face a health challenge.
And with this being a health conference, I imagine there's a lot of you that have been on the spectrum of healing, from being those who have actively worked on your own healing process and those who are also healers and both. And so we thought that since there's a shared interest in health and that this is the theme of the conference, that it would be appropriate to give you a template for how to heal yourself or how to deal with a serious health challenge. And so because I had this experience last summer, we thought that it would be a really good opportunity. And I want you to know this is only the second time I've talked about this publicly because it was a very private experience. And so I'm really grateful that you're here, that I can share it with you. And to echo what Tim said, our goal is to really help inspire and to motivate you to create your own healing template or to have a powerful healing template to share with others when a really serious health condition or health crisis comes up. So as Tim said, sometimes with people there's this response where you find out about a really serious health issue and it's suddenly like you're a deer in the headlights. And what do you do with that? And ironically, last January we had a health reunion where we were actually modeling people who had had really serious health challenges and how they had dealt with it. How many people were there in the room? Was anyone there at the January one? Just a few of you. We modeled three different people who had had really serious health challenges. One was a guy named Don D. Demarius, and he doesn't mind us using his name, but he had had fourth stage liver cancer that had metastasized fourth stage colon cancer that had metastasized to his liver and then to his lungs. And he was able to heal himself from that all the way to the point where he's just got one tiny little speck in his lung. And so it was really interesting last January to hear his process, how he dealt with that. And then there was Bob Phillips, who had fourth stage prostate cancer. And so we got to hear his healing template as well. And then, of course, Tom Gourley, who had a stroke, and he is 75 years old, and he recovered from that. So As we were saying earlier, and as Tim was saying, health has been a mission. It's been something that's been in the real foreground, and it was a really interesting experience for us to look at what these people were doing. Well, right around that same time, I have a private coaching practice, and I started getting all these clients who had really serious health issues, specifically cancer. And one client had a fourth stage colon cancer. Another client had a cancerous tumor in her jaw, and they were talking about having to remove part of her jawbone, and she was really scared. And have you ever had those? How many people in here work with clients or do one-on-one work? Okay, a lot of you. Have you ever had those times in your practice where, like, maybe you're having a relationship issue and suddenly you start drawing in people that have relationship issues? Or your life is feeling really out of balance and suddenly every client, their life is out of balance? Or you're trying to cut back on drinking and suddenly you get clients that are trying to cut back on drinking. Well, I was getting clients with really serious forms of cancer. Now, I've worked with serious illnesses in the past, but this particular time, especially on the heels of this health reunion that we had done, and I was editing a video of Robert and Tim working with a lady who had fourth stage cancer. This little voice last spring during all of that popped in my head and said, "Gee, I hope I don't have something cooking inside of me." So anyway, and I hadn't been feeling well, and I knew I hadn't been feeling well, and I had been actively working on myself, but I had no idea what was wrong. I thought maybe it was a adrenal fatigue is the big thing now or something like that. So I was working on myself. Finally went to the doctor for a routine checkup, and this would have been last May. And one test led to another test, to another test, to blood work, to an MRI, to a CAT scan, to getting the phone call at 8 a.m. in the morning from the doctor who says, "I've cleared my schedule for the day. Come in anytime you want. I have something very important I need to tell you." And I rolled out of bed because, you know, we were still asleep, and I knew something was terribly wrong. And my very first thought was my parents. I thought, oh, my poor parents. We had lost my 37-year-old brother to a very rare and aggressive and deadly kind of cancer. I was their only child left, and I suspected that whatever the doctor had cleared her schedule for the day for, it was going to be very bad news. And so, sure enough, we got there, and we knew that there was a mass or something, because that was what the MRIs and the CAT scans were for. And it turned out that I had a large abdominal mass, and after all of the blood work and the test and the MRIs and the CAT scans, the doctor basically indicated that I could or I was in the final stages of cancer. And as you can imagine, this was quite a devastating blow. And because there was so much cancer in my family, because my brother had died, both grandmothers had died of cancer, my uncle had died of cancer, I had an aunt that had a really serious kind of cancer, they felt compelled to act really quickly, and I'm really grateful for that. So we went home, and we basically worked for about 3 weeks, and there was a surgery. And my parents and the doctors and the oncologist at the Monarch Cancer Center were all in alignment in the fact that we had to get the mass out of me immediately. So now some people have had growths or whatever, and they do all this work to try to reduce them or to make them disappear, which might be completely inappropriate in whatever the context is. In the case of my brother, because he had such a actually it was, the rarest and most aggressive and fastest growing cancer known to mankind. And he had a growth in a tumor, and the doctors thought it was maybe a slow growing kind of tumor, so they waited 3 months to take it out. And so when they went into the surgery and they got inside and looked at him, they came out of the OR room and basically told my mom, this is a really very serious and aggressive kind of cancer. We give them a 0 to 5% survival rate. We give them 3 to 6 months to live. And he was basically dead within nine months. So because of the experience with my brother, everyone, thank goodness, was in alignment that we needed to get whatever was going on inside of me out. And then from there, we would begin whatever the treatment protocol was. So as you can imagine, this was a lot to take in. I was very, very scared. I was frightened. I was having panic attacks. I was in shock. Susie talked about disorientation during her talk. Robert was talking about the hero's journey. It was all of those things combined. And so Tim and I got home, and we began to work, and worked all the way up until literally the minute that they wheeled me into the operating room. And I went in for the surgery, and when I woke up from the surgery, I was still in the operating room, and I was laying on the gurney, and I saw this big blurry block. It was a head, a nurse's head, moving towards me. And it was coming towards, you know, I was still pretty doped up on all the anesthesia. It was moving towards me, and it got to my ear right here. And she whispered in my ear, I just need to let you know that you're in the operating room, and we've just finished the surgery. We got it all out. And it's benign, and you are going to be fine.
And they did a checkup a month later, and then 3 months later, and the total bill of health.
They did multiple biopsies. The oncologist and the team of doctors came by and said, We really suspect that there's no cancer there whatsoever, but we're going to continue running tests. And they took multiple biopsies and, you know, just said, we're going to keep running tests for a couple of weeks. And then they called me a couple of weeks later and said, we just cannot find anything anywhere in your body. It is completely gone.
So there's no point in coming back. So she didn't. But yesterday when Robert was giving his keynote and he put up the hero's journey, I thought this process of healing was interesting because it's kind of what we went through, not consciously doing the hero's journey, but I think it's what we ended up doing. So the first thing, when we had this call from Chris's primary care doctor, the one basically said, I'll clear my schedule. We went in, and she was talking about this. What she'd found, and she was. This woman is incredibly good at rapport, and
this was my oncologist.
Well, no, this is Laura.
Oh, Laura, right, the first doctor.
And Laura said something. That's her main doctor, her primary care doctor. And she talked for a while and about the different tests and what had come back, and she was really vague. And then she said, you know, it's hard when you find, you know, cancer in a late stage like this. And so it was. Chris went kind of numb. And I realized at that moment I couldn't. So the first one on there, induce a generative healing state, became the first goal of what can we do to create something where it's a place for healing and not a place for being sick. And so we actually did a number of different things that we thought we'd go through that I think made a big difference. One is we immediately did, even before we went in to see Laura, since the CAT scan had showed something strange, we'd already done like 6 hours of re-imprinting, trying to find whatever imprints could be there that could contribute to it, what kind of conflict?
This was before we even knew what it was, and we had already done like 6 or 7 hours worth of work. And well, one of the things I want to talk about when we went into Jennifer's office. And so one other little piece of the story is I got sent, well, we had a couple choices of where I could go receive treatment, and so we chose the Monarch Cancer Center in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is where I'm originally from, and I've got a lot of family there. And
by the way, the first doctor had given us a set of, you know, possibilities where we could go. So we immediately went online and investigated who were the people. Because, you know, the caregiver you have is going to make a total difference in your experience. And so we wanted people who had either good reviews or who we got a good vibe off of or who we thought we could talk to.
And so we chose the Monarch Cancer Center. And so we went in there and we started talking with the oncologist about my case. And she, thank goodness, she had great rapport skills, high EQ, very, very sensitive. So I was really grateful for that. But she had to tell me what I was up against and what I was facing. And she was literally talking about all the different scenarios of just how bad this could be and how they would try to treat it and what type of organs would have to come out. And it was just very scary and very frightening, but she did a beautiful job of delivering it. She had to tell me. And so at the end of all of that, I looked at her and I said, well, what's my best case scenario? And she said, oh, well, gee, we get it all out, it's benign, and you're fine. And I was like, really? And so I asked her, well, have you ever seen that happen before in all your years of experience? And there's a big, long pause, and her eyes are darting and darting and darting. And finally, she says, yes, once. I had this woman, and we operated on her, and she ended up having, and it was like this big, long name I didn't understand, and she was okay. And so when we walked out of Dr. Rhodes' office, I told Tim, well, looks like we've got about 16, 17 days to manifest the best-case scenario.
And so that's really creating the healing container here, this idea of the best-case scenario.
So as Tim was saying, we have a kind of a healing template that came out of what we did during that time that led all the way up to the surgery. And the first piece is something that was very serendipitous with Susie in the video that she showed of W. Mitchell yesterday. And I don't know if some of you saw that, but in my journey and in any journey, a very key piece is to take responsibility. Do not be a victim.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to fall into this place of feeling angry and resentful, and that was actually the first thing that we did re-imprinting around. We spent about 2.5 hours with some pretty big systemic imprints around that, and I think that maybe was the real tipping point for creating the healing container, because if you're in a state of resentment or anger or blame for something, it's going to create all the biochemistry that you don't want for a healing like this. So that's basically where we put a lot of energy immediately.
And also, once you can get all those negative chemicals and emotions out of your body, then it opens you up to being able to really go after the true healing in a really high way. So the next thing is, don't let your diagnosis or your disease define who you are at the level of identity. Because a lot of people, once they get a diagnosis of cancer or MS or I know Carrie does a lot with Lyme disease, that becomes your identity. So the first one was take responsibility, Tim. And the second one is don't let your diagnosis define you. And with my brother kept saying, I'm going to fight this thing. I'm going to beat it. I'm going to win it. And his whole identity was around surviving the cancer, fighting it, beating it. I did not want to fight what was going on with me. I especially did not want to beat it. What I did want to do is I wanted to become really good friends with it.
And you'll see that was kind of a theme going all the way through here, which is kind of like the third one, welcome to the shadow. Yeah. The symptom, what is the symptom? It's not the enemy. You know, remember Pogo? We met the enemy and it is us in the comic strip. And if you treat yourself that way, you know, if you're dealing with some kind of issue and you say, well, that's the enemy inside of me, then you've created a conflict. So instead, the idea that we had was to welcome it as having some positive purpose. There was a meaning in this. It wouldn't be there for no good reason. And to start honoring that in a lot of different ways.
So I became really good friends with it. And the first thing I decided is I did not like the name large abdominal mass. I just...
And so I
figured that it didn't like the name either, so... So I changed it, and the new name, it took a day or two to figure out the new name, but the new name was my healing shrinking part.
And some of you may know Susie's story, where she was years ago in Idaho riding her mountain bike, going down a dirt road on the remote place. Bike hits a rock, and she went over the handlebars face first into the rock. And blood all over, gets to the doctor, and the doctor looks at her and he says, you've smashed your face into a rock. And of course, Susie, knowing the power of language, everybody try that. Just say, I smashed my face into a rock. What happens inside your body when you do that? And since Susie knows all this, she said to the doctor, no, I kissed a rock. So try saying, I kissed a rock. And doesn't that bring up different neurology? Then he said, you're going to have a big scar. And she said, no, I'm going to have a little line. And she was telling me this on the phone the next day, and I said, we'll call it a disappearing little line. Because your body believes every word you say, and when you start languaging things differently, it makes a big difference. I had a woman once I worked with who had bloating around the midsection, and she'd been to many doctors her whole life to try to resolve it. And she wasn't, like, overweight, but she had this kind of wide middle. And so I had her, she asked me about it, and I had her drop down and, you know, become, she called it her stupid fat stomach, by the way. That was her phrase word for it, and she kept using that phrase. And she dropped down inside and felt a lot of anger and later discovered it was a kind of a belief that she'd formed. It was a contract she'd made with her mother to not be competition for her. So her mom would say things like when she's a little girl, when you lose your baby fat, you'll be cute someday. But she agreed to stay this way so she wouldn't be competition for her dad with her mother. And so now she was 46, though. She didn't need that. So, but she changed the language, and it went away. That's all she basically did. She started saying, my girlish figure. And it just disappeared. She relabeled it. So this idea of labeling something can make a big difference. And if you... when I broke my leg years ago, I called it my remarkable healing leg. And sometimes you start doing that, and you're telling yourself what to do differently and giving different messages in your body. So Chris renamed hers.
So I renamed it, and I became friends with it, and I was constantly thanking it. Thank you for the message. Thank you for the healing. Thank you for the opportunity. I got it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I would literally do that about a half hour a day during meditation.
So that's kind of like number four there. Yeah. And she was actually doing a lot with gratitude. There's research that shows if you're in a state of gratitude, it can affect your immune system for up to 6 hours. HeartMath has a lot of information on that if you want to go on their website and read some of the research on that. So states of gratitude actually produce different kind of healing chemicals in your body. So there's also something very powerful about saying thank you. What's the presupposition there? When Chris is saying, thank you for my healing. You know, yesterday Robert said the only way out is through. But notice that takes you to the end of it to create some representation of already healing and not being in some ill place or not feeling well. So she spent half an hour just going into a kind of a meditation around gratitude.
So we did that, and that was all pretty early on. Another thing in creating a healing template is to carefully figure out who your support team is going to be. And when I say carefully, that's a support team is to consist of people who can truly support you. And so my support team was Tim. My oncologist was so great. She immediately bought into what we were doing. She just immediately, she saw that these were your not average patients, so to speak. So she bought into it, and she's like, oh, yeah, you know, that's possible. We could open you up, and it could be all better, sure.
But it was also really important that we had somebody that we had that attitude. You know, if she'd just been a cold clinician and, you know, who was a technician rather than somebody with a lot of heart, it wouldn't have worked the same way.
And go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say, she just really became part of the team, and we'll talk about some other things that she did later that were pretty cool.
Were remarkable. And my mom has a tendency to be very resilient in these type of situations, so she was a key support member, also bought into my story. And of course my dog, he didn't know what was going on, but he was an important piece of it.
And this idea of a support team and which one am I looking for? Yesterday Robert was talking about the Miracle on the Hudson. And Sullenberger, who had to keep this calm, positive attitude that could be reflected in other people. One thing your mother did was a total trooper that way. And I remember Chris told her what was going on, and she said, oh, you don't have cancer. That's a bunch of crap, basically.
Well, and then she actually called me after we first told her about 20 minutes later, and she said, I need to tell you that just because your brother died of cancer, I don't think you will, and here's why. She said, I had an intuition that your brother would die. I do not have that intuition about you. This was the first time she had ever told me this, right? Well, about a month after my surgery, when we found out it was all benign, I said, Mom, what did you think when I first called you and I told you all about that? What was your initial reaction? And she said, oh my gosh, I was so scared. You had no idea. I thought you were like a goner, like your brother. I didn't know what I was going to do.
But up till then, she'd kept saying, well, you know, you don't have this problem. And she'd keep bringing up all these people she knew. You know, she said her husband, her current husband, Tom, had been to the doctor and he had some kind of lump and it turned out to be nothing. She said, you know, Tom had the same thing, exactly the same thing as you did. He's fine, and you know, they get it wrong most of the time anyway.
So, and that was...
We're in the waiting room and I said, well, how are you doing? She went,
Yeah, so it's important to figure out who your support team is, who I intentionally did not include on my support team, and I actually... He knew something was going on, but he didn't know the full scope of it until about two, when we found out I was really free of cancer, was my father. And my father, I'm very, 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 very close to him, but when my brother got his diagnosis, he'd go out and have a couple drinks, call my brother up, you don't have cancer, you don't have, you know, you're going to be, well, fine, and then he'd start crying, and then, oh, I don't want you to die, and I just thought, I can't have that going on. I can't have to be rescuing other people. I need to be rescuing myself.
And the thing is, sometimes you tell people what's going on, and you get this kind of reaction. People come up and they go, tell me, how are you doing? How are you doing?
And then my mirror neurons are kicking up.
But then she has to rescue the person.
Right.
And so we had long talks about it. She didn't want to go around rescuing other people here. So we told virtually nobody about this. And Chris was real adamant. I don't want anybody to know. And we only told like three people.
Who knew the real true gravity. And instead, we took 3 days to carefully craft a story. And that's the next piece.
A story that would be honest, but would also wouldn't put people in that place where they thought they'd need to. By the way, we had a bigger support team too. Susie was actually part of our support team. Because I had a contract to go do a training in London, and Susie came back from China. In Brazil. Same difference. It was a long ways away. But you'd flown forever, and you got back, and then like a couple of days later went and covered for me, which was totally nice.
Yeah, it was such a fiasco, just Tim trying to reorganize his training schedule created this big domino effect, and thank you, Susie, for flying to England on the drop of a hat. I know that's not your normal style, but we on that short of like a couple days' notice, but thank you for that. So the next one is to carefully decide the story you do want to tell. So after I talked to my mom, I realized that this was going to be really important, how I told people. And this was on a Thursday when we found out. So I didn't actually start. There were only a few people that I told, and I picked up the phone on Monday. But I spent the whole weekend trying to think, how did I want to tell people, especially my father? And so when Monday finally rolled around, I picked up the phone and I called my dad. And instead of saying, "Dad, they found a large abdominal mass. They think I'm in the final stages of cancer. I have to have a surgery," kind of like what Doug had, you know, my brother. "And I've been sent to the Monarch Cancer Center, and I'm working with a team of oncologists." Instead of that story, What I told my dad instead is, I said, "Dad, I've had some tests. There was a routine exam. It looks like they found a growth in my abdomen. I've met with the specialist, and we've decided that we need to remove it. So I'll be having a procedure in about 2.5 weeks, and you know, hopefully it's all going to be really good. And so I just ask you to visualize the best outcome for me." Well, of course, he flew through the roof, you know, because of what happened with my brother. And I was really grateful, though, that I never, ever once told him the cancer word or any of that. And he was really, really worried. I mean, really, his mind automatically went to where my brother had gone. And I kept telling him, and this ties into the Sohlenberg message that Robert was telling, and it's about creating the field. I've been a big fan of systems theory for a long time, and I had this belief that if I could get everyone in my field believing the same story that I believed, that it could help change it, and I needed that. So I started asking my dad, "Dad, just visualize the best outcome for me. Visualize me coming out of this procedure, and I'm totally healthy, and it's all good." And I just kept asking him that. And sure enough, about 2 days before the surgery, he called me, and he said, "You know, the whole family's been sitting around talking about your situation," because, of course, you know, with what happened with my brother, even though they didn't know the seriousness of it, they were all really scared. So he said, "The whole family's been sitting around talking about your situation, and we all have a feeling that you're going to be okay, and you're going to be fine, and that there is nothing wrong with you. And you have no idea what a little mini victory that was for me, going into surgery knowing that I had that kind of support in my greater field, that they were visualizing the best outcome."
And I think that's really number two again, you know, helping to create that healing container. So how do you want people interacting with you and coming to you and reflecting with you?
Well, and there's this idea of mirror neurons, too. So if you can kind of be putting that out at the system, then it's going to be reflecting back to you as well.
So the next piece is, we started doing work right away. Like, remember when Robert's mother had the reoccurrence of breast cancer, and you said you basically worked with her all day and into the evening. You only took time to sleep and eat. And that was kind of what we did as well. We did that for 16 days. And so what we kept doing was contrasting, where are you now? What could prevent the healing? Whatever came up, we'd work with it. And so we did, I don't know how many hours of re-imprinting, things that you never have to deal with. You know, we talked about the shadow side, and sometimes they're shadows we don't even pay attention to. We get used to them and put them away, and these shadows would come up, and when they did, we would re-imprint them, or we would do belief change work like we do in the Wealthy Mind with it. And
every night around between 6 and 7, I'd have a panic attack. And so it was so great to have Tim there, because we would do different NLP processes, and there's so many great ones like eye movement integration that you can do.
That we use sort of as first aid. So you get in those moments of terror, and you know, how many of you are familiar with the eye movement integration? That, you know, have the person think about what it is, move through it, and that clears a lot of it. And we also did probably the most common thing was the dynamic spin process, and we kept spinning different things out, you know, symptoms or issues that we'd have or that she'd have, and you know, it'd make a big difference.
Another important piece, and I actually got this from Don DeMedeiros during the health reunion, which ended up being a really important piece for me, was he was talking about how you hold both ends of the spectrum. So meaning you hold the end of the spectrum of, yes, I could die, this could be the end, and also the spectrum of I can beat this, or not I can beat this, but I'm going to be okay, I'm going to be healthy, and to really learn to hold both ends of that spectrum. And in a sense, it's addressing the shadow side of what can happen, or the negative intention, I think, is what the Japanese people were talking about. But really honoring and acknowledging those parts that you don't want to. And that's what I noticed about my brother, was he was so positive. I mean, he was going to beat this. He was still working. He was flying around, giving talks and speeches. But he was so afraid of this other piece of dying, and he really never allowed himself to go there. And I think it's really important to be able to address both ends of those spectrums. So I'm really grateful for Don DeMedeiros.
It's one thing you might do is make a list of all those NLP processes you know and keep them in front of you so you don't forget to do them. Because things will come up and it'll be the right time for the right thing, like some kind of, like, you all know six-step reframing or integration or communicating with the symptom or some doing, you know, the dynamic spin release kind of process or those different ones. If they're there, you're not going to forget about them. One of the things that we did twice a day was a hypnotic session. And I talked to Chris a lot about what she wanted when she was, you know, I said, when you get through this and you're all healed and you're better, what is it you want? So we're creating kind of an as-if frame. Then I started building that into making a hypnotic process with a compelling future in it. And also as part of that, Chris had, being a spiritual person, had been taking phrases from people like Joseph Murphy. How many of you are familiar with Joseph Murphy?
He wrote The Power of Your Subconscious Mind.
And he's a positive thinker. He was a New Thought kind of minister, but he has a lot of nice affirmations that I think they really speak to healing. So Chris took some of those.
And there was a parable out of the Bible, and I've never really read the Bible or been a religious person, but when you get a diagnosis like that, you become religious really fast. So I called my mom and her husband, who are very religious people. They know the Bible inside out, and said, are there any biblical quotes you could give me to meditate on? And there's one that my stepdad gave me that comes out of, it's Matthew 25. It's something Jesus said, which is, he said, pray for the least of your brethren. And when you do that, essentially you're praying for me. And so in other words, what he was saying is, he was saying, think the very best, or visualize the best of those around you, because when you do that, you're visualizing the best for Christ. And this is the way my stepdad explained it to me. So me, being the systems thinker that I am, because I've always loved systems theory and systems thinking, I interpreted it that if I start blessing people around me, visualizing the best of those around me, then in turn, I'm really helping the greater field. And if I'm feeding in and I'm helping the greater field and I'm a part of that field, then that's going to be a good thing.
There's an old saying, bless the thing and it'll bless you, curse the thing and it'll curse you. And so Chris was blessing her body, but blessing other people that she could think of.
I spent a lot of time praying for other people, and I've done that before, but not to the extent that I had done it this time. And even asking people, what do you want me to pray for you? What do you want? And I have some friends that don't believe in God. So the way I would say it is, what would you like me to visualize for you? If you could, you know, what is it in your life that you want to make happen now? And I can visualize that for you and hold that container for you or hold that space for you. And I found that to be really healing, almost just as healing as it was in me visualizing the most positive outcome for myself. That was really, really powerful. And what I notice is sometimes when I can't sleep at night, I'll just start doing that and nothing else, just praying for other people, and it just puts me right to sleep. So that was another thing that we...
So we incorporated a lot of these sort of spiritual sayings into this script and sort of mental script, and we do that. And I kept doing it, saying the same things in different ways in that, just so it would get reinforced in different ways.
And part of that, though, even extended to all the organs in my body, including the healing shrinking part, in the sense that and this would be another piece, is if you are dealing with something like this, is actively communicate not only with the quote-unquote healing shrinking part or whatever the symptom is, but for me it was really important to communicate with all of the organs that had been holding the space for the healing shrinking part. So I spent a tremendous amount of time literally going to every organ in my entire body, talking to it, checking in with it, asking how it was doing, spent a lot of time talking to the healing shrinking part, and literally every day for about an hour I would do a meditation around that. And that was really powerful too. I started telling my other organs, look, our friend, the healing shrinking part, is going to be leaving soon, so let's make room. And I talked to the healing shrinking part and, said, let's make it easy to leave, and are you okay with that?
And, of course, you can see these submodalities, right, that she's doing in her mind here.
So that was another really powerful
piece. By
the way,
the backdrop for this number five, believe in yourself and what you're doing and curious about what's possible. I think we never once talked about what could go wrong. And I think holding that space of not talking about, well, what if, you know, this happens or what if that happens was really a good thing. Because even if when you have these moments of panic or terror or whatever both of us had, you can't go there, I think. You want to hold this idea that it's all possible, you can make it happen, and it's going to happen in a healthy way. One way to do that is to develop a kind of a core question that helps your sorting principles as you go through. And so, Chris, we talked about that, and Chris had one.
It was, what is my best possible outcome, and how can I heal myself as quickly as possible? And so that was the core question that I was holding. What is my best possible outcome? What is the best case scenario? How can I heal myself as quickly as possible? And this idea of best case scenario as a theme really kept playing out. How many of you have seen the movie What the Bleep? Has anyone seen that? And there's a scene that always stood out. There are a couple of different scenes, but one of them is the scene where the kid's playing with the basketball, and he shoots it, and he misses it. And they start superimposing all these different possibilities of what could happen when the little kid shoots the ball, where he misses it, he makes it, it flips in a different direction. And they related that to our life, how in any given moment you can have multiple possible outcome happen. You can leave this room today and you might run into somebody that you don't know. You might suddenly see a cart that's got a pitcher of water on it, and so you drink the water. You might trip and you could hurt yourself. I mean, there are so many different outcomes, and I don't want to plant that there, but I started thinking there's multiple realities that could play out for me. One reality could be that literally they go in to the surgery, they open me up, and they are like, ugh, and they just sew me back together and say, and Tim actually knows somebody that had happened to. Or another one could have been, it could have been like my brother, where they got inside and said, this is really bad, and you're gone. Or they could have gone inside and said, well, we got it, but there's still a lot more there, and it's, you know, we could take this organ or that organ, and it could, you know, my brother couldn't swallow the last 6 months of his life because of all the radiation, and he would never, ever be able to eat or swallow again. So the point being is there were so many multiple scenarios and realities for how this could play out. The reality, the scenario that I wanted was that it's, they get everything out, it's benign, and everything's fine.
So that's an affirmation she created and said it over and over again.
But over 1,000 times a day.
Her doctor had said that when she said, what's the best case scenario? And the doctor said, well, we get it all out, it's benign, and you're fine. So Chris just repeated that. So that's creating that kind of set of images in her brain and not something negative. And that helps keep you out of those dark places mm-hmm. that Chris was just talking about.
So they get it all out, everything's benign, it's fine. Over and over and over and over, I said that, I visualized it, I visualized the surgery, I visualized somebody coming to me and telling me that. And it was so surreal when that happened. And there's something, I get goosebumps when I think about it, because when you think about that movie, What the Bleep, and you think about systems and the field and the relationship that we have with the field and that we are part of the field, and you start thinking about how powerful our thoughts are. Ernest Holmes, who came up, was the founder of the science of mind, said that life is a mirror and will reflect back what the thinker is thinking into it. And in a sense, that ties into this idea of the field, that whatever you're putting out there, you're getting back.
Another piece is negotiating with all parts of yourself. You kind of mentioned this, but all of getting support, a sense of support from all of your organs. I remember at one point after 10 days or so, Chris said, I feel a release. And it was like this healing, shrinking part that said, okay, I'm done. But she had to kind of coordinate with that with all the different parts of her, especially the parts around her.
And then part of this visualizing the best possible outcome, it was important for me to project into the future, way into the future. I wanted to know I was going to have a future, and it was going to be a healthy future, and it was going to be a future where I could eat and I could swallow, and my body was going to be functioning normal. And I've always wanted to go to Spain since I was 13 years old because I minored in Spanish and I started taking Spanish. And you'd think with as much as I travel, I would have been there by now. And so Tim had made that promise to me, we will go to Spain next year.
So serendipitously, a guy calls us up from Mallorca and wants us to go do a training in Mallorca. And, which is an island off of Spain in the Mediterranean. So we said, okay, that was the next June.
But then we planned a 3-week vacation with that. And so sure enough, we were able to go and do that. But it was nice for me to be able to visualize into the future something that was beyond just me being healthy and healing.
And as part of that, you think about creating a compelling future. And I think this is what you said. Consciously made one of the biggest differences was by really thinking through the kind of future that you want to have. So some elements to that you might want to consider is you think of yourself as being in that place of being healed. And how do you want to be physically? So how would you look and move and act? How do you want your body functioning? Here you might think of the macro level, you know, how do I want to look and move through the world, the micro level, how do I want my organs to be and my tissues. You can think about how you want to be interacting socially. You know, how do you want to be connecting with other people? How do you want to be sharing your life with the people around you that you work with, that you interact with, that you interface with? And this turned out to be a really important one for Chris about how she wanted to move through the world with other people. Then mentally, what kind of thoughts do you want to have? How do you want to be thinking about things? So how do you want your thinking to drive your experience? Where do you want your mental attention to be going? Then your emotions, what kind of states do you want to have access to, and what kind of states of mind do you want to be in? Of course, we know that if you're in certain kind of states, you're going to promote health and well-being and joy in your life.
And you'll be producing certain biochemicals in your body that support that healing.
And how do you want to be spiritually? You know, how do you want to be connecting with that's beyond or beyond you? So what we did is we sat down. I've been incorporating bits of what she'd been saying in these hypnotic kind of inductions for 3 or 4 days, but we sat down and we spent an hour going through this and kind of interviewing and talking about it. And once we had this really fleshed out about what she wanted, then we incorporated that into this hypnotic script, and we would do it at least twice a day. And if you're doing it on your own, you could certainly do this as a kind of into a like an iPod or something, and then listen to it yourself.
And what's so amazing about that is who I am today is what we had been doing in the hypnosis script. And so now I keep thinking, why didn't I just say or wish that I was 5 pounds thinner? It's like, just another 5 pounds, you know. But, you know, it's like I'm at the weight I had wanted to be at for so many years. But not only that, but my identity level is where I want it to be at, and my own comfort in my body. It's really interesting, though, because there's a saying that, you know, ask and you shall receive. And there's some literalness to that. And it just amazes me today that literally what we had co-designed in those hypnotic scripts is what I became. And a lot of power in that. So even if you don't have anyone that can lead you through hypnosis, you can develop your own script and put it into a tape recorder. I know for Robert did that. He made an audio recording for Deborah, and I know she's been listening to that a lot. So, or you can even do it with yourself. I know Tim's made audio recordings for himself as well when he's wanted to work on things. The next piece is something we'd like you to think about, and we'll give you an opportunity to actually get with somebody and talk about these, because these are things that you can begin to do right now. This is not only prevention, but it's maintenance, and it's also part of the template of how to heal yourself. And this is a really practical one, but what are some of the practical lifestyle changes you can make? So, such as changing your diet. It's interesting. I have this friend I went to high school with who became a licensed counselor. He's in San Diego. He's one of these really charismatic people that he manages to get on the news, and he gets all this media publicity and doesn't know a lick of NLP or any of the alternative type stuff we do. And I was watching this television interview with him, and he was talking about working with people, and he said that before somebody even comes in to his or not before, when a client comes into his office, the very first thing he'll ask them is, what are you eating? Are you exercising? Are you sleeping? And at the time when I heard that, I thought, well, that's so easy. What about the imprints and the conflicts? But about 50% of it really is, what are you eating? Are you exercising? Are you sleeping? What are some practical life changes that you can make to either prevent something happening or to aid you in your own health? Some of the things I was doing a lot of deep breathing techniques. We were spending a lot of time in nature. We were out hiking a lot. I got permission from my oncologist to exercise, and I exercised like crazy. Changed up my diet dramatically, cut out alcohol, dropped down to one cup of coffee a day. And what's nice is I've pretty much maintained all of those things. And so what I would like to to ask you and then to give you an opportunity to actually get with somebody and talk about what are some things that you can do today that are either can be preventative or can just contribute to your own health and make you even healthier. What are some dietary changes that you can make? Or maybe you've already made a lot of dietary changes. Tim and I have made mass changes, but one thing we did about a month ago, well, for me it was about a month ago, for him like three, is we completely cut sugar out of our diet. And so that's another little piece. So what are some things that you can do? And I know some of you are already extremely healthy. Maybe you've got diet down.
By the way, there's something now called erythritol. Are you all familiar with that? Or xylitol?
Xylitol
is not as good. Erythritol is even better. It's zero. It's a sugar substitute, but it's actually your body produces it. It's totally natural. It's totally healthy.
Yes, but you spell
it. You know about it, Kelly?
No, he said spell it. It's actually, it's better than stevia. I've never been a fan of stevia.
Well, and stevia has that weird aftertaste. Some people like it, but this is no sugar, no glycemic index.
Yeah.
It looks like sugar. It tastes like sugar. So it's, you know, there's no deprivation. How many of you saw the movie with Meryl Streep and what was that? When were they go to heaven?
Where they go to heaven.
Defending your life. You ever see Defending Your Life?
Yes.
And, well, with, I can't remember the other actor that was so good in it. But anyway, these people would die and they go to this judgment city and they'd go through all this stuff. But the one thing they said, they kept saying, you can eat everything you want, you don't gain weight here. And it's kind of like with this stuff. It's the same way. So check it out. When I dropped off sugar, I lost 20 pounds and never gained it back. And Wayne Dyer talked about the same thing. He just quit doing sugar. But if you do this, you don't even have to be deprived. And you can, it's a little bit more expensive than sugar, but boy, it makes a difference. And if I eat sugar now, I feel a real buzz that surprises me. So check this stuff out.
How many people in here do apple cider or take apple cider every day? There's some real health benefits. And that
Bragg's apple cider vinegar?
It has the mother in it.
The
right.
One with the mother. The Bragg's is the one that probably is the most famous.
So there's a lot of dietary things that you can do, and for some of you, you're probably doing about as much as you can do that way. But what about exercise? Are you exercising every day? I know Robert runs for an hour a day.
One of the goals here for Chris was when she went into a surgery 16 days later, she wanted to be in great shape. And actually, after the surgery, one of the surgical nurses came out and said, you know, your being in that condition made it a lot easier for us. So it's something to think about if you're going to have something like this to get into great shape. The other thing Chris did was she listened to Susie's preparation tape for an intervention.
The pre-surgery tape. If you are going in for surgery or you're having a medical intervention or you have a friend or a family member or somebody that you know, listen to Susie's pre-surgery tape. You can get it on her website at susiesmith.net. So that's another one. But just what are some practical things? Like maybe just, oh.
Well, just one other
thing. I was just going to say that. Go ahead.
Notice how you're thinking. If you're thinking negative thoughts, you're going to create negative internal experiences. So one of the things that we talked about, and Chris even asked me to do, is to call her on it. If she was going into a negative place. But I wanted to be aware of that too, being in my, as a part of the support team. I didn't want to start complaining about things or, you know, if I come home, you know, complaining about something else, what kind of state's it going to put her in? So when I caught myself doing that, I'd change it to something positive. And we got stopped watching a lot of certain kinds of TV. We let go of totally.
Yeah.
No more certain news programs. You watch political things, you get incensed about, why do it? It's just hurting your body. So we started ignoring that. And we started watching uplifting TV shows. You know, actually, Disney shows work for adults often as well as children. If you watch something heartwarming, you can feel a difference in your body versus watching one of these news programs where they're just vilifying everybody else, right? Phyllis? Oh, China study. When we were thinking about diet, we started doing investigations, and there's a video called the China Study. Maybe a book.
It's actually Forks Over Knives is a much better, which is a much better video, because the China Study is great. It goes a lot into the science, and if you want something a little more user friendly, either the DVD or the book Forks Over Knives.
Forks Over Knives.
And what it is these scientists found that there's exceptional longevity patterns in China, and he was able, it's the biggest...
Certain parts of China, actually.
It's the biggest health study that's ever been done before, but what he was able to determine is that when you eat certain types of foods, literally it switches on genes inside of your body that form cancer or diabetes, and if you cut these foods out, it turns off the genes, and he did all these experiments in mice to prove that. And so, of course, the foods are all dairy, all meat, and sugar, a little bit of sugar.
Sugar is, in a lot of diets, sugar is not very common outside of the Western world. Remember years ago, Chris and I were watching a movie, and it was a cowboy movie, and it was back around the 1900, 1890, something like that. And somebody made a pie, and these actors, and they were just savoring this pie. And Chris, I remember Chris saying, you know, I bet people back then only got sugar once a month or something. That, whereas nowadays, you know, it's in corn syrups and virtually everything, right? So you can't avoid it.
So the goal is, and one quick.
Hungry for Change.
Hungry for Change. Is that great, Kimmy? Thanks. So Hungry for Change is another one about sugar. But even if you cut back meat or dairy or whatever significantly, not even just cutting it out, but cutting back, it makes a big difference. Yeah, Phyllis?
There's a book I've been reading that it's called Younger Next Year, and I really recommend it. They originally were called Younger Next Year.
Younger Next Year.
That's a book?
It's very humorous.
A book called Younger Next Year.
You'll just be laughing through the whole thing. You'll be like, I'm not going to do that. And then they tell the story, and you're kind of laughing.
Let's have the group break and talk about what they can do, Tim.
Well, I think...
You want to... Okay, go ahead.
By the way, the other thing that Chris did, and we've both done a lot of, is journaling.
Yeah.
And you get your ideas out, your thoughts out on paper. You know, if you have a dream, you write it down. There's a book called The Miracle Manifestation Manual.
The 15-Minute Miracle Manifestation Journal.
And we'd highly recommend that, as it gives you a format for doing it. But it's got a little place to remind you to do gratitude in there and to set your goals and to think about what it is you want. And 15 minutes, and this woman that wrote it, Jacqueline Aldana, her husband had four-stage cancer, and he started doing this process every day, and it went away. And they basically thought he was finished. But this is what made the big difference for him, was this idea of journaling. So journaling is another thing you can do. I've got photos of Chris out on our deck, journaling away during this time.
So there's a lot of practical things that you could do. And what we'd like to do is give you a few minutes to talk about what are some immediate practical things that you could do in your own life to help create more health and wellness. And then afterwards, we've got about three more things, and they're the most important ones of all. So what we'd like to do is give you about 5 minutes each to find a partner. Talk with somebody about what are some practical things that you could do to help either prevent an illness or to help maintain your health and wellness.
Think about the things you do every day that may drain you instead of nourish you. Like, how many of you go on Facebook and then wonder why you spent that much time there, or on email?
So five minutes each. So we have just a few more things to go over with you. The next piece is that if you are going to have a big surgery or your client is, one thing is to contact the surgeon if you can and let him, I'll just tell you how, I wanted to talk to the surgeon before the surgery. It was an oncological surgeon. So I called her office and they told me you can't speak to the surgeon. So, because I just wanted to tell her my story.
I couldn't speak to her because she wasn't there. She was in operating.
And she had a really busy schedule, but they basically said, you're not going to be able to speak to her before the surgery. That doesn't normally happen. And I said, okay, well, how about if I send her an email then? What's her email address? Well, she doesn't really read her email. So basically what happened is they said, look, email me, the receptionist, and I will give it to the surgeon to look at. And the whole purpose of this was, you remember when we talked about the story that you tell? I wanted the surgeon to know what my story is, which is that I'm wanting the best possible outcome. I believe in the power of creative visualization. I've been praying and meditating that this surgery it's going to be smooth, it's going to go easy, it's everything's... And I just detailed everything that I wanted in that email letter. I actually spent about 2 days working on it.
Yeah. And it's the whole idea was setting intent. And the frame Chris had on there, she says, my intent is to be healed, you know, to come out of there and it's going to be over with in a healthy way.
And that it will be a smooth and easy surgery. And
basically, Chris said, I want the same from you.
I want you, as you're operating on me, to be really visualizing that it's going to be a good experience. And not only that, be visualizing the best for me before the surgery. And so, finally, when I was separated from Tim and the gurney was pulled away, how many people have seen that movie 50-50? If you haven't, you should see it. It's about a kid that undergoes really similar situation that I did, and he has to go in for a surgery, and he has no idea what the outcome is going to be. And that was the same as me. I had no idea what the outcome was going to be. So it was very emotional when they wheeled me away from Tim. But I got wheeled right into the hands of my surgeon. And she walked over, and she had my letter on her clipboard. And she said, I want you to know that I got your email. I've looked at your letter. I have been thinking about you and your case for the last week. And she said, I have been visualizing the best outcome for you, and I'm hoping it's... And she named off that big, long word that you know was named off earlier. She said, I'm really hoping it's that. And then she turned around and she walked into the operating room, and I could see her in front of me, and she walked in like this. And I just remember looking up and thinking, I am in good hands. And that was such a great way to enter into the OR room. It really alleviated a lot of the stress and the anxiety that I was having. So if you can contact your surgeon, do. On the last one, there's a few other things we'll talk about, but the last piece of the healing template, if you're going to go into a surgery, we have a few things for recovery after surgery, is to let go and trust. And that's a really important piece. On the morning of my surgery, I was in bed and I was praying. My surgery was scheduled for about 10 in the morning, and they won't let, you know, you can't eat or drink any water or anything. And I was in bed praying and meditating and visualizing how I wanted the surgery to go. And all of a sudden, I heard thump. And I knew what that sound was. I knew that sound. I hadn't heard that sound, that thump. I hadn't heard it in a long time, but I knew what it was. I knew that a bird had probably smashed into the window. And I don't know if I told you, but part of my healing was spending time in nature, and we have a bird bath in the front of our house, and we spent a good amount of time watching the birds in the bird bath. Sure enough, I open up the drapes, and there's the little chairs, my chair and Tim's chair, and the bird bath in the front yard. And there is a dead bird laying in my chair. And my first thought was, why did it have to hit my chair? Why couldn't it have landed in Tim's chair? And I was so upset. I mean, I was doing like all the mathematics. Okay, there's 365 days in the year. And here it is, the morning of my surgery. Why couldn't this have been like tomorrow morning? Or why couldn't it have been this afternoon when I was already gone? And I went inside and I suddenly went into that victim mode. Like, oh, why did this have to happen on the morning of my surgery? And I really got upset. And Tim was like, gosh, I hope you're not letting this bird thing upset you. And it... It really did. I mean, he so gracefully took care of the bird and buried
also
it.
So it's, you know, maybe it's a death to something else, an old way of being, or
yes.
In some native circles, animals will sacrifice themselves for you. It's like their connection with you. They provide.
So maybe the bird, you're saying, in a way, sacrificed itself as part of the system.
If you didn't hear what Sharon said, in some native circles, they think that an animal will sacrifice itself for you. And I got goosebumps when you said that. My father, later, I told him the story, and he said the same thing. But at the time, my mind couldn't quite go into that space. And so I went in, and I had developed a practice, which, again, this whole healing template is designed to be a healing practice. So I just got straight back into my practice. I went into my meditation room and started journaling and did the 15-minute miracle journal. And it was during that time when I realized the lesson is I need to let go and trust. I need to not read too much into what happened with the bird. I've just got to let go of all my expectations. It's no longer in my hands. It's in something else's hands.
And in all the years I've worked with people with big health challenges, this idea of kind of surrendering, trusting, having faith that it's going to work is one of the real healing kinds of states you can be in. So having faith in what you're doing, belief in what you're doing, trusting in what's happening, it makes such a huge difference.
And part of that is tying into this idea of really having a belief in a higher power, whether that's God or Jesus, or even if you don't believe in that, then in the universal life force or the energy of the universe or something is such a key component. About a year ago, we had a friend that got very ill with fourth stage pancreatic cancer. So I got really fascinated with, because we were going to, Tim and I were going to have an opportunity to work with him, and sadly he passed away before we could. But I started, in preparation for that, doing some research, and I found my way into this, one of those chat rooms on the internet about people who have healed themselves or who had healed from fourth stage pancreatic cancer. And as I was scanning through everybody's stories, there was one common theme that every one of them had, just one. And what that theme was pretty much at the end of all their stories, they all basically thanked God or they thanked Jesus. They all, the ones who actually beat it or survived it, had some type of a belief in some higher power outside of themselves. And so that's a key component of the surrendering, the letting go, and just turning it over to the greater field, whatever that might be for you. And then another piece is setting up a healing space. So I did that before I left for the hospital because I did not want to be convalescing or healing in our bedroom. I just did not want to contaminate our bedroom. And so for those of you, if you're in an apartment, maybe there's a couch space you could set up, or if you have a house, set up some type of a space. I have a room that I set up before I left for the hospital so I could go in there in the day, because it took me a couple months to recover from having abdominal surgery. So I wanted to be able to really spend time in that room, and I could see trees and just really created a healing environment. The other piece is when I got back from the hospital and I was okay, one of the things, it's just a real natural thing. You're in recovery, so you wear your I'm not working, I'm in recovery, I've just had a big surgery clothes, right? So you don't put makeup on, you wear sweats, you kind of walk around. Well, I couldn't quite walk, but I was getting there kind of like, and I'm in pain. And Tim was like, no. Enough of that. So he really encouraged me. He said, you need to get dressed every day. You need to put your makeup on. You need to look as good as you can. And so I was really grateful for that feedback, because, again, even just looking in the mirror, if you think of mirror neurons. And so what kind of message are you sending to yourself?
To yourself. Good thing is to get out and active.
Yeah.
By the way, one of the things that happened is I'm really paranoid about hospitals and infections and stuff like that. So we got her out of the hospital in one day. Her doctor was surprised.
She actually called me the next day, and she's like, oh, so I see you broke out. And she was like, good for you. But I had to pass a couple of tests. They wanted to make sure, number one, I could walk, and number two, I could eat. And I showed them I could do that. So they said, okay, you can go. And then they made me walk out. And so that was a good thing.
Then using your compelling future to support the recovery is also important.
And so with that hopefully you got some good ideas for if you're ever going through a situation, or a loved one is going through it, or even in your own private practice in terms of working with others, because there's a lot more than just doing the straight up NLP. I mean, that was so important. We probably did, we were doing it every day. I don't even know how many hours, but a lot. But there's all these other practical and spiritual things that you can do as well. And so we're hoping that we gave you some good ideas for that. And with that, we'd like to end on a story, which is several years ago when I was in college. I was a professional writer. I was getting my degree in psychology. And at about the time when I was 19 years old, I got, to me, which was the assignment of a lifetime, and this would have been like about 1984, 1985, but my editor pulled me aside and he said, look, Timothy Leary is going to be blowing through town, and because you're the senior staff writer and you're majoring in psychology, we thought we would give you the interview or the opportunity to be his hostess while he's in town for 3 days.
You're all familiar with Timothy Leary, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a psychologist from Harvard. He sparked the whole psychedelic revolution, the whole tune in, turn on, and drop out. So the college gave me a car. They gave me some spending money, and basically I was Timothy's guide for 3 days. And I mean, what's a 19-year-old to do with Timothy Leary, right? So I was trying to set up all these different parties with my friends so I could impress him with my friends, and we could party together, because that's what you want to do with Timothy Leary, right? You want to party. And so I took him to this party, and I was like so proud. And we walked in, and everybody was kind of partying and drinking and whatever. And I was, Timothy and I were kind of side by side the whole time. Anyway, this really drunk guy showed up at the party, and he literally started attacking Timothy Leary. And he's like, "Mr. Leary, what do you think about this and that?" And he was literally like right in his face, really drunk, you know, waving his finger, really pretty much verbally attacking him. And I was like, "Oh, this party's not going how I thought it was going to go." And was feeling very self-conscious. And anyway, all of a sudden, Timothy did something very, very interesting. He and I were sitting down together on this couch, and right in the middle of when this guy was yelling and screaming at him, he just kind of, almost like a Jedi, he just kind of lifted himself up out of the couch, and he walked around into the kitchen. It was one of those things that are kind of circular. Walked back around. It took about a minute to do this. And walked back into another chair in the living room, another location, and sat down. And of course, I, even then, being the modeler, I had followed him and came and I sat down next to him. And what was weird was it was like literally he dispelled all the energy in that moment. The drunk guy completely disappeared. It completely changed the whole energy of the party. And it was almost like whatever had been going on never happened. And so I turned to Timothy and I said, "What was that all about? That, you know, getting up in the middle of that and walking around, and now, you know, we're sitting there, and now we're sitting here, and what gives?" And Timothy turned to me and he said, "Well, if you don't like where you are, get up and move."
So we've gone over. Thank you all for being here. And if you don't like where you are, get up and move now. And Sylvia, you have an announcement. So. Thank you all for being here.
Yes. Yeah.